Hey everyone! Last week we released this video. You saw some people moving their bodies, doing some kind of activity,
and having a pretty good laugh. Truthfully, they were playing a brand new adventure game for Nintendo Switch. It's a bit different from what you would expect.
It's an adventure game first and foremost, but you'll actually be moving your body. You might even break a sweat while playing. It's called
Ring Fit Adventure.
Hey everybody, welcome back to the NExpress Nintendo Podcast. I am your interim host. I'm always an interim host. Patrick Murphy, filling in for Tim Mason, who could not be here today. But we have a really great show. We still have a packed house. Of course, joining me is Ricky D.
Hey Patrick, do you remember the days when we started the podcast and it was the Wii U days, and each and every single week we had to get really creative to try to think of talk spots, and now it's like we can't keep up with the amount of games being released on the Nintendo Switch, and I'm not sure what I prefer. Like, because back in the days we had to force ourselves to be creative, but now we have so much to talk about that each and every single week we always say it's a jam-packed show.
I know, we used to have a lot of weird topics, which was fun, but we also complained a lot that the Wii U had no games. So we're never happy, essentially, especially me. But maybe some of the stuff on this show can make us happy. Also joining us is Goomba Stomp writer Campbell Gill.
Hello, everybody. I'm glad to join the podcast when we actually have a ton of stuff to talk about.
Yeah, and he recently reviewed Daemon X Machina for the Switch, so we're going to be giving you that. But before all that, we have a very special guest. We're going to be talking about Creature in the Well, the indie that recently released for the Nintendo Switch. And joining us is creative director Adam Volker of Flight School Studio.
Hey, that's me.
Adam, we are really glad to have you, because Rick and I have both been playing this game. I've basically gotten all the way through this game, and we have a lot to talk about.
I'm so glad.
Before all that, though, Rick has a tradition. We have a tradition here on the NExpress where any new guest has to run the gauntlet of answering five random questions that Rick has selected. So I guess they're not random. But he has tailored them just for you.
Right? Lovely. Shoot.
All right. So my first question is, I want to know what your favorite comic book is.
Ooh, Akira. Easy.
Nice.
Akira for millions of years. I push it on all the people that I meet. I have 6 copies in the office. I just gave the first one out today to somebody who hadn't read it. But man, I love it. It's like the Wagyu A5 beef of comic books.
Yeah, I'm actually writing an article about Akira. And the thing about Akira is that as much as I like the movie, the comic book is way better. But what's interesting about the comic book, it was actually being developed while the movie was released. So the movie was released and they were still developing the comic book. And I think the problem with the movie is that the story is so convoluted and it can't just fit everything into like a 2-hour film. But that's why I always recommend people to read the actual comic if you do like the movie, because it's so much better.
I didn't know that.
Oh,
I
yeah. Mean, like, they actually started filming the movie, and the comic book wasn't completed. And then, you know, anyhow, it's just huge, whole long story.
Awesome.
I'm going to get into now. Question number 2. You now live in Montreal. What is your favorite place to hang out in Montreal?
Ooh. So I'm going to, shout out to Four Origins Brewery. So we work at a building called Nordelec, which is on the Canal of Chine. It's the south, like nothing's down here. But there is this local brew pub that has a really, really nice patio a few blocks from the studio. So it's a nice spot to, after work, unwind, have a local beer, or stuff like that.
I actually live about 10 minutes away. So that's weird.
Oh, yeah. So you know what I'm talking about.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Okay. Yeah. Awesome.
Question number 3. What is your favorite video game of all time?
Oh, God. Hit me with the hard stuff.
We love this question.
Yeah, I know, right? People try to weasel out of it, I'm sure. Of all time, I'm gonna answer this, and then I feel like at 10 o'clock or like 3 a.m. this morning, I'm gonna wake up and have a different answer. Like I should have said, the game that really changed gaming for me was Halo Combat Evolved. I was in high school when it came out, and when we figured out that we could plug the Xboxes into each other and they had names, and we hosted a tournament, and my science teacher made us a whiteboard, and he moved our team names around, and we had pizza and stuff. Like the AI in that game, driving the Warthog in that game, like that was the new steez for me. And so I just gaming blew up when I played that for the first time.
That sounds like a really cool teacher.
Yeah, he was. We definitely didn't deserve him. Yeah.
Question number four: what is your favorite video game console of all time?
Ooh, the 360, I think.
Ooh.
I think it's because I started to play like not AAA stuff, and I think it's when I also played like the first big indie stuff on there, like Fez and Braid, the Behemoth games, the Castle Crash. Like, yeah, Castle Crashers on the 360. We were like, oh man, you can just make small, cool little things to play with your friends. And I think it's still my favorite controller. I don't know. I think that's probably a different debate. But anyway, I'll say 360.
That's a bold choice for a Nintendo podcast.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I grew up on the NES and SNES, so I feel like it's kind of just part of my DNA. I don't even mention it anymore because... I played Quest 64 and didn't beat it because it's too hard.
Quest 64. Me too, actually. I have the exact same story.
Yeah.
All right. And I guess the very last question I will ask is, what is your favorite soundtrack of all time? It could be from a video game and or a movie or a TV show.
Probably the Fez Disaster Piece soundtrack.
Yes. Disaster Piece is amazing.
So it's what I draw to now. So like when I'm storyboarding or doing concept or whatever, you can put that on and like hit every spectrum, every part of this emotional spectrum you're going to need to draw from to do good art, to do the draws good. And I just listen to it over and over and over. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. I do the same thing with Disaster Piece's other soundtrack for writing. Like, I listen to Hyper Light Drifter all the time.
Yeah, for sure.
So inspirational, man.
Yeah, that is actually one of my favorite soundtracks in recent memory, at least from a video game. Yeah. All right, well, I'm pretty sure you passed the five questions. Do I ask Campbell the five questions now, or do we wait till after?
I say we dive right into Creature
of the Well.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm happy to talk about the game, too.
So my first question kind of revolves around what everybody is referring to this game as, and I wanted to get your take on this because I want to know if this is sort of a narrative that you guys put out there or if that's just what's been happening. But the idea that this is a pinball game, I guess having played it, it never felt like a pinball game to me. And for anybody who's unfamiliar, Creature in the Well, you take control of this sort of robot character named Botsy, and you go into this mountain and you go through various... I don't want to call them dungeons, but it's kind of like dungeon crawling in a way. And various puzzle rooms within this, I would say. And you solve puzzles by hitting balls of energy and forth off of bumpers and off of, sort of enemies and other projectiles and things like that. And open up doors with by getting currency from doing all of this. And so you're basically working your way from room to room, solving puzzles. This is a very much, to me, a puzzle game. It never felt like pinball to me, but I wonder what you guys think. Were you guys thinking pinball when you made this?
I'm so glad you say that because we weren't. we had like some really awkward, weird gameplay references when we started. Bo, sort of the other counterpart to the core development team, was really inspired by Rocket League. And so like controlling a ball with a weird object was something we talked about a lot. Obviously the dungeoning or like the campaign, if you will, the story part of it was from those old Zelda SNES, like Link to the Past games. But pinball became an easy shorthand, and that's why we use it. I mean, obviously, like when I was designing the bumpers, it was like, well, it would be stupid to not reference visually reference pinball machines. We just thought that was a fun like nod. And then obviously like we tried to look at what was fun about ball games like Breakout and pinball, and like what's fun about having multi-ball or one, what's fun about like sneaking a ball behind the line of bricks and watching it bounce around. So like those references were in there, but yeah, we weren't, it's just kind of like such an awkward little game that, or weird little different thing that when we talk to people about it, we usually start with like, it's a hack and slash pinball game because people, you know, we can bring them up to what it actually is much quicker.
Yeah, and more people are more familiar with pinball than they are with Breakout. I definitely think it's closer to Breakout because you're often eliminating those bumpers, right? Like instead of getting points, well, you are getting points in a way. That's what the sort of the voltage, the currency that you unlock doors with is. But it definitely felt more like Breakout where you're trying to get rid of these things to solve the puzzle, essentially.
For sure.
So the thing that really grabbed my attention about the actual game is the visual style. And that's why I asked you what your favorite comic book is, because like the thing is, Kyle, when our indie games editor over at Goombastomp.com, he wrote a little piece about Creature in a Well, and I read it and I was like, this is very positive, but it was the actual GIF, the screen captures that he put into the article to capture my attention. So I want to know, what is your inspiration for the actual visual style of not only the game, but even the creature himself?
Yeah, so I'm glad you asked about the creature too. The visual style, and you've nailed it, is inspired by Mike Mignola, who's the creator of Hellboy. I'd done some paintings, you know, early on, like what we wanted the town to look like, what we wanted the mountain to look like in the interior, but they weren't really doing it. And as we started to build the game, we needed a visual style that was clean and simple, but sophisticated. It had to be simple because like once the balls start bouncing around and the VFX start going off, like the game is very frenetic. It's very visually complicated. So we needed something that like would not try to also be high detail to like complement that gameplay. So comic books were a good place to go. And then when I was looking at the paintings I'd done, I was like, they need to be simpler. And I'm looking at them right now. You can't see them, but behind me are a bunch of the like Hellboy. I think, what do I have? Chained Coffin and the Wild Hunt and stuff like that. And so I picked it up and I was like, oh, like this. And so, you know, I like just trying to do my best Mike Mignola impression, to be honest. And then the creature itself was a budgetary creative combination. So we, being a team of two and like neither of us principally being animators, we're like, how do we create more people in the world for the player to talk to? And so we came up with this character who was inspired by Oscar the Grouch. We were gonna put
Sorry, I'm just picturing that now.
I have this doodle of a character who talks to you out of a little trash can, and like we're like, oh, we'll do comic bubbles coming out of a trash can. And we're like, cool. And then we added like scary eyes, and we're like, ooh, that's spooky. And then we're like, let's put him in the well. And we're like, ooh, that's spooky. And then we're like, what if it was the bad guy of the game? Oh, that's great. So then we put him in the dungeon, and we, you know, like the story evolved out of that. But it was very piece by piece. And it came out of the fact that like we were trying to just add people to the world without having to like fully model, rig, animate, and texture of another character.
It works so great because it keeps him hidden and so mysterious, but you see his hand every now and again, and like his head may pop out here and there. But the eyes, I love, especially even in the rooms where the eyes are looking at you, but he's not talking.
Yeah.
It's really ominous.
It's funny because I've done a couple drawings now of what I think the creature looks like, but I've resolved to never release them. They will go with me to my grave because I think it's much more interesting to have players imagine it than like for me to be like, this is the creature, here he is. You know, it's much less interesting.
What's cool about the creature is that you see him, but you don't really see him. Like he's hiding in the shadows, but he does talk to you. And I thought that was a really interesting choice. I'm just kind of wondering like why you decided to actually make the creature talk to your protagonist.
Yeah, we wanted, you know, just to tell this, like find vehicles to tell the story that weren't just the player reading lore on the wall, which is still cool, but like we needed another flavor, you know, like in our food stuff that is creature in the wall needs a whole bouquet. So we said like, why not make the antagonist like active you know, talk to you, and it's very anime. I all the streamers are like doing voices of the creature, and then as soon as they started doing like emo anime voices, I was like, oh yeah, totally nailed me. But you know, like we really enjoyed sort of having him be, or it be, the vehicle for like some of the what happened story, and you know, just sort of like antagonize the player, like, I bet you won't finish. We wrote a line where he's like, you will abandon this task, I will wait you out. And just kind of poke the player, just keep encouraging them to play.
I was going to say, I think it really built the tension, because it starts out kind of almost a playful mocking banter with the creature, but the further you progress, he starts to get a little irritated. And so his conversations start to become even more menacing as you go on. And that really builds something that the lore tablets, I guess, if you want to call them, that you find in certain rooms, they sort of fill in a mysterious backstory, but this creature is what's actually building the tension.
Yeah, yeah.
Being a Nintendo podcast, and I remember we said this way back in the day when Shovel Knight got released and the developers came on the show, we were like, can we get an amiibo and can you put Shovel Knight in Super Smash Brothers? Could you see the protagonist and the creature being added to Super Smash and having an amiibo? Like, is that a possibility?
That would be a dream come true. I mean, I don't know where the decision-making board for that decision is, but yeah, let's do it. I think it'd be great to have the creature be one of those like environmental super moves, right? Because we could still not have to see it, and we could still put it in the game, and you know, we put Botsy in there somewhere. That would be so great. We have a friend who is a 3D modeler, and he's like, can I have the model for Botsy so I can do a 3D print of it? And I've just been like geeking out ever since he mentioned he was going to do that. I cannot wait to see it in like the physical world. And amiibos are great. Yeah, I have a bunch of them.
It would work perfectly with the hand too, with the model creature's hand. Yeah. I mean, that could come down from the sky, and the eyes could be looming in the background. It's awesome. All set up perfectly.
Yeah.
So as a creative director, how do you start out? You sort of explained how you sort of came up with some of the world and stuff like that. Is it just sort of banding about ideas? Do you sort of go back and forth and the thing sort of develops over time? Or did you guys have a pretty strong vision when you first started out of what you wanted? Or did you just start out with a mechanic?
Yeah, it's mostly the latter two. I can't speak for like the game development process as a whole, but our approach is very piece by piece. Bo and I are playing tons of stuff. And what we do, it's kind of like, what do we wish we could play that we're not able to play? Like, what's that? What would we love to try that like is not out there? Or like, we also just kind of nerd out about the details in certain games. I don't know if y'all have played Katana Zero, but we talk a lot. We've been talking a lot about just the dialogue in the game, not even the gameplay, but just like the timer and how juicy it is, and then like how it affects the story. And then there's that one scene, which I won't spoil, but like really where he like uses it to like tell the story, and like I'm trying to talk about it without talking about it. Anyway,
I know the one you're talking about.
Yeah, I know, it's so good. So that's how we start. We're kind of like, you know, what wouldn't it be cool if is always the first question, and then it's prototyping. And then it's playing, and then it's getting other people to play, and then you find out whether your idea has legs really quickly. You know, I think that any idea that like needs a lot of development to prove itself is just really risky. It's very fraught, and that's not how we like to approach stuff. It's kind of like we had a bumper, we had some player controllers, a ball, and some bumpers pretty quickly. And if people like, we built some really dumb puzzles, and people played them, you know, for about an hour. We're like, okay, well, this probably has legs. And then like you said, it was before mentioning the art style, how that evolved. It's the same with mechanics and other parts of it. We had, you know, do we build dungeons? Do we use RNG to make it a roguelike? Do we have, what kind of weapons do we have? Do we need a town? How do we traverse the dungeons? Like, what puzzles are interesting, what puzzles aren't? And it's always about iterating and testing and then cutting ruthlessly.
Well, the game relies on moment-to-moment gameplay, so I would imagine it was hard to develop just the actual controls of movement of the characters. Like, can you talk about maybe the difficulty in making a game like this?
Sure. So that polish is credited mostly to Bo. He was really dialed in on like how quickly the dash works, and like, you know, we didn't always have a catch weapon and a strike weapon. We had or charge and strike, what we ended up calling them. We had mechanics at one point where you could attract the ball with a meter from anywhere in the room, but then it kind of turned into this paddle ball game. We didn't have the currency for a while. It's really just kind of like, and that player controller specifically is, you know, one of, it's been iterated on all the way up until, you know, close to shipping. That stuff, like if it doesn't feel right to do that, it's, you can't build an action game around it, right? Sorry, did I answer your question? I just started rambling as I was thinking about all the things we've done along the development. You were asking about moment to moment, or?
Well, yeah, it's because like, okay, so I've had the unfortunate bad luck of playing three games which I just completely disliked. And so when I picked up Creature Noelle, it was like a breath of fresh air. I'm like, oh my God, first of all, this game is amazing, okay? You know, we bring on you as a guest, not just because we want to promote the game, but because we actually truly love the game. There's so many indie games. There's so many games on Switch as is that sometimes we feel like, you know, a game could get pushed down. Maybe forgotten about. Like there's a game like What Remains of Edith Finch. Fantastic game. One of the best games I played last year. And you can't find it on the Nintendo eShop. So one of the things about the game that I love so much is the controls, the movement. Like I find it so smooth and it just, it doesn't feel like a chore playing the game.
That's awesome. I mean, it's just iteration and testing, you know, like there's a great development scene in Montreal. We go to a place called Gameplay Space, shout out to Gameplay Space, downtown. And when we were an early dev on Creature, we would bring the game and just have and talk to the devs there about, you know, immediacy of like the dash, if there were iframes, you know, like how to add animations to the sword swing, but like, you know, like where variation and where reuse was going to come in, all of that stuff. So like, it's just, you know, about testing, I feel like, and iterating and then giving it space to really polish before you ship it.
Right. Campbell has a question for you, but I'm going to ask one more question quickly because you mentioned Gameplay Space, you mentioned Montreal. That is an incredible organization establishment they have. There were a bunch of like developers, be it like indie developers, or if you work at Ubisoft, what have you, you can all meet and share that space and share ideas and network. It's fantastic. But yeah. Montreal is just blowing up right now. As far as the video game scene is concerned, what do you think it is about Montreal that attracts? Because you're not originally from Montreal, right? You're from Dallas, or
I'm from Minneapolis, but I was living in Dallas. Yeah.
Well, I'm living in Minneapolis right now.
Oh, shout out to Minneapolis!
Yeah, I'm Minnesotan. I like it.
Flight School, the head office is in Dallas. You guys have just That's a 2-man correct, yeah. team in Montreal that made this game. So, like, why would you move to Montreal to make this game as opposed to go to Dallas?
Well, it's a bit of an opportunity, to be honest. So, like, the real answer might not be as interesting as you're hoping. Flight School Studio is owned wholly by a animation feature film studio called RealFX. And RealFX is also headquartered in Dallas, Texas. They were moving up here for tax incentives. The major productions that they are in up here, there's 350 people at Nordelec working on cartoon movies, and so Flight School is like, sure, we'll do a Canada office. And so Bo and I were like, we want to do that, and here's our idea, and here's our budget, and let us do it. And they're like, cool, go do that. And so it was a bit of an opportunity for us, like just kind of like strike while the iron's hot sort of thing. And also like, we're still really close with the Dallas studio. So in the credits, you'll notice like modeling and animation and other things that we didn't do wholly up here. That was all the Flight School team in Dallas, Texas.
Cool. Well, I remember the very first time I saw the game, and it was in the Nintendo Direct earlier this year, the Indie Direct. And I just want to know, what was it like having your game featured in the Nintendo Direct, and how did that whole process come about?
It was scary and exciting and perfect. I think like that's right where we would want the game to be, you know? So that was our announcement. And the announcement of a game is probably the part that I'm most nervous about. I was more nervous about that than about the release last week. Just because no one had reacted to it on that scale yet. Like we weren't sure if it was going to be interesting to people, if they were going to be like, oh, this sucks, stupid indie game or whatever. but like we couldn't
like to judge.
Yeah. That's how we do. but we couldn't have asked for like a better, you know, beat, as it were, to like announce with Nintendo at GDC, which I love, as a conference, and like sort of be featured among all those other like really incredible games. And it's just kind of about like how it came about was just kind of like, you know, submitting what we had and talking to people and just trying to like get involved. But yeah, it was great. It was super, super, super great. And we were also at the Indie Mega booth at GDC. And so we were sort of like all sitting at our station, which was in like Moscone West, and like watching stream, you know, with some donuts and some coffee, all of us together who were at GDC. It was really fun. It's really special.
Clearly working with Nintendo is like a big deal. I'm guessing you grew up playing Nintendo games, but what are the challenges of developing a game specifically for Nintendo Switch?
Yeah, no, there are. I mean, it's not the most powerful machine on the market for consoles. And so that comes with compromises. It's funny because the game visually looks simpler than it is, you know, like it's always taped together stuff, right? So it's good that it looks clean and really efficient, but it's not my fault mostly, but it's not always. So people think of the Switch and they're like, what's great about it is like, it's a console on the go, you know, you can drop it right into the dock, it pops up on your TV and all that stuff. But I always use mine for airplane rides and commutes. You know, that's when I do a lot of Switch gaming specifically. But you know, like the difficult part is bringing the shaders and the custom stuff and the lighting, all of that, like to that piece of hardware. There's technical challenges. And then I think another really big hurdle for us was the joysticks, because the game is so detail oriented and the Joy-Con's analog sticks aren't the greatest. So
yeah,
we've always
tried this now.
Yeah. Okay, cool. I didn't want to offend anybody. But you know, so we've been recommending people play it with a pro controller. And that makes the experience much, much better. But that was a concern of mine, porting it to that console. I think the length of the game is really, really a good fit for Switch. I do think like the visuals fit really well on the console, and I've had player after player after player come to me at conferences and be like, oh yeah, Switch, that's great, it's perfect. And it is, but it, you know, those are sort of the two big hurdles, the control scheme and then the visuals.
I do want to second that the pro controller is definitely better. I noticed that as well. It is a game where there is definitely some precision. Obviously, things are bouncing around a lot, and a lot of times you're just caught up in the action. But there are definitely some moments where you need that precision. It is not by any means like it plays great on the Joy-Cons too. I just prefer.
Sure.
But I will say that the way it's structured really, really suits the Switch, because these rooms can be done in, you know, they're kind of quick challenges. So you can sort of take little bite-sized gaming sessions,
right,
and have it save and move on and then come back to, you know, it the next time. So I love the way it's set up. It is one of those games. It's the best kind of puzzle game where you were talking earlier about the mechanics. It's got such a simple premise for the mechanics, and it works so well and feels so good. There are all sorts of little wrinkles that you can throw in with the weapons, which I'm glad you guys did. That means you can experiment with loadouts and all sorts of things, and the catch and the throw. But it has that. It must be difficult to create. I'm as somebody who does not make puzzle games, how hard is it to create that kind of game where it can be challenging? Because this game has had me cursing at my TV screen. And yet I'm always looking over my shoulder at the clock, because I usually play these, you know, late at night, and yeah. I want to do more. It never got to the point. There's a certain kind of frustration you want to quit, and there's a certain kind of frustrating where you want to beat it. This is the kind of frustrating where I want to beat it.
Right on.
How do you do that?
Oh man, you know, I don't know, to be honest. Like I'm so glad that you said that, because that, you know, like you really want the one, but you really don't want the other one. Mm-hmm. As a developer, right? I think it makes me think more about when we were pitching the game to publishers, and we had a bunch of them turn us down, and we got some really good feedback from Nigel at Devolver, and I shout out to him a couple times because he really helped us pivot the game. But he was playing an earlier build, and he's like, you guys, I don't know if you have a game here. Like, you have a fun mechanic, but, like, can you keep my interest with it for more than, a, you know, 20, 30 minutes? And we were like, oh, no, he's right. And at that time, we didn't really. And so, Bo and I kind of went back to the drawing board, and Bo built these 8 demo rooms, a lot of which are the very first rooms in every one of the dungeons. And then what I did was take the demo. Sometimes he made new mechanics, because his, you know, principal job is engineering. And so he would make new mechanics or whatever and then be like, this is an interesting puzzle, this is interesting, and separate them and make them really individual. And then I built the dungeons kind of like off of those. And then we bounced stuff back and forth and whatever. But like, I think that's when the game turned a corner for difficulty and engagement, if that answers your question. Like, we had some bumpers, but we just had a bunch of rooms with bumpers and it wasn't interesting. So it wasn't even challenging. It wasn't interesting. And I think we found that interest after we did that exercise. And then I think we just had to trust that the references we were pulling from were gonna be universal for people. The difficulty discussion has been coming up a lot, you know, after, you know, in this last week, almost week of launch. Because I've, you know, we get a lot of people online that are like, this game's stupid hard. And I was like, really? Oh, I'm surprised. I didn't really expect it to be. There's obviously a couple boss fights that I knew were going to be challenging, but I didn't expect it to the reaction to be that people were really struggling with it. And I think it's because we don't actually, the game's not long enough to teach you how the nuances of like how to be really, really good at the mechanics, because they're so weird and new. And so Bo and I been playing, you know, playing it for, you know, over a year or whatever, felt like, you know, this is a good amount of challenge for us. Let's take, and that's where we were. And then we made it a little easier and then we shipped that. And then to get the feedback, like, what the hell, this is just so hard. it's like, whoa, what if we hadn't, you know, even cut what we cut? But I really just think it's because like, the amount of time the game gives you to spend with the mechanic isn't long enough for the difficulty spike that comes in the late game, where, you know, I don't know. That's my best guess.
It's interesting because it's puzzle, but it's reflex based, especially right. When you get into that late game, when all these projectiles are coming at you, or, you know, there's these posts on the columns on the floor that might shoot out a ring of damage. Yeah, there's a lot of reflex involved in that, and I think that's definitely where the challenge comes through. But nothing ever feels impossible, though. And I have to go. It's the simple and satisfying mechanics are what make nothing feel impossible. It can be hard, yeah, but I don't know. I felt like, well, here's another question for you, because this also might determine whether some players think that it's hard. You guys allow for a lot of freedom in which paths you choose, and some paths are harder than others. What went about, you know, somebody might choose a hard path earlier than they should and not realize that they should back out and go a different way, maybe.
Yeah.
Maybe pick up some more weapons, because weapons can really help you with some of those challenges. How did you guys come to the determination to allow so much freedom instead of having something be very linear?
I think if we give the player the choice of the difficulty, then it takes a little bit of the pressure off of us as the designers. Mm-hmm. And players will get less mad at us, I think, if they know they're walking. Like, I made a choice to walk into the hard room and I can't beat it. It's not like my fault as a designer, you know, I guess it's kind of how we thought about it. And so we also didn't really put like easy, medium, hard as a selection in the game. We instead made the doors always available to you as players, right? So you've got enough money and you're at a puzzle you don't like, you can just push through it. The only times you can't do that are in the boss fights. But otherwise, we wanted you to be able to just skip stuff. You know, like let's say you grind it on a puzzle 10 times, you're getting energy every time you grind, but you can't beat it. It's okay to like, just decide to walk up to the door, open it, and move on. We're not going to require you to do that. And that's kind of how we created like a dynamic difficulty within the game to allow players to be like, maybe there's a puzzle we designed that we just didn't polish enough or didn't dial in enough. And so people are like, yeah, screw this. I'm just going to pass it. They don't have to get gated by that.
Although I will say, you should try, because there's a lot of secret items in the game.
Yeah.
Oftentimes those hard puzzles will open up a secret.
Yes.
I think there were two that I just, I ran into them early on and I thought, nah, I can't handle this. I'm going to come back later when I have right. better weapons. So that having that option is great. Just being able to power through, and you can grind if you want, but so that only the bosses are the only things you really have to deal with. But those hard puzzles do teach you a lot of techniques. So I love that it's up to the player. I think that was a great decision, and it does make it less frustrating when you can walk away. It makes it far less frustrating than a lot of puzzle games that just sort of force you to beat something until you can move to the next one.
Right.
Now, one thing I wanted to ask about is you've already talked about the visual style, which is super, super impressive and super stylistic. But what about the sound design? Because I remember when I was watching the trailers and I was just listening to like the synths and everything, and then hearing like not only the music, but the percussive sounds of the ball hitting everything.
Yeah.
How did you go about the sound design? Because it's a really notable aspect of the game.
Oh, awesome. I'm so glad. So that was one of the folks in Dallas. There is the same guy who does sound design for the feature films and the commercials that the studio makes was also the guy who helped us out. His name is Frank Pittenger. And so just a number of phone calls with him. He's got like a proper setup down there. And, we just sent him a build of the game. He's not really like a gamer himself, but he was happy to, mess around and play with it. We sent him a bunch of video edits and then we would score to that. A lot of the logic part is Bo. So like, how much we use this software called FMod, which is really cool and dynamic. You can set things like randomly pick between these sword swipes, or when the chime hits, the chime of a ball hitting a bumper, you can tweak it this way. The more power it has, dial the pitch up a little bit for every inch of power. So it's like part programming, part sound design. And it's a really robust tool. It's super fun. We're just pulling the references, like what's fun about watching a ball bounce between a bunch of bumpers in an actual pinball machine, that rubbery bum 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 sound, and then like the dinging of the bells, and like what's our electrical version of that. So just having a lot of fun. One of the coolest sound effects in the game, I always love talking about this, is Frank found a great sound for the scream of the creature, because he was asking us, like, what does the creature sound like? Does it talk to you? Does it make, does it vocalize, whatever? And we're like, we don't know, but we don't want it to be just like a scream. So the actual sound that he found, which is in the game, is the sound of a person taking like a cello bow and dragging it across a cactus. So it's such a great sound. And so he just one day was like, you guys. And he sent us a link to this website. He's like, I found this person who's been recording cactuses. And we were like, no way. And so that's the sound. It's not like, straight out of the box, but it's like, that's the core of the sound, pitched up and pitched down, and like with a few other bits and bobs mixed in. But like that screechy sound is actually a cactus. It's so good. It's such a cool sound.
You've got to love sound guys.
Yeah, I know.
Stuff. Amazing.
Yeah. The stories of sound design that float around are just the coolest stuff. Yeah.
To bring up one movie reference, I don't know if you've ever watched Barbarian Sound Studio, but if not, you should watch it. It's a great like horror film, and it's about this one specific guy who does all the sound effects for horror films, and it shows how he does it, and it's fantastic.
Awesome.
I was actually going to pinpoint the sound design in this game too, because it a lot of times people talk about the soundtrack of video games, but they forget about the actual sound design, and it's really unique. And I mean, the art style is still my favorite thing about the game, but I would probably put the sound in second place. The game is really hard, though. But I'm also like a big fan of a game like Celeste. Like, to me, it's not a problem. So I'm wondering, like, the people on Twitter, are they like just sort of making, addressing the fact that it's hard, or are they actually upset about it?
I think it's a mix, and it's funny, like from a developer perspective, like, when a tweet just says this game's fucking hard, you're like, okay, like, I don't know. I can't hear you say it. I don't know whether you're like, hell yeah, after it, in parentheses to yourself, or if you're like throwing your controller and you're like, gonna review bomb our game on Steam or something. Like, I don't know on the spectrum where you're landing. So like, it's really weird to, I just don't engage those. Right. You don't know how to engage those. But like difficulty and whether that's fun, for some players like it, some players don't. You know, who are we designing the game for? I think you've got to trust that you know the testing you've done along the way has set your expectations in the right place, and then you've got to hope they're outliers, and if they're not, then you know what can you do to fix it. It's really, really difficult. Like, is it the most common thing? Is it just the loudest thing on the internet? Is it, you know, it's really hard to know.
Have you guys learned anything by the reaction? I can tell you what the first really big challenge in the game for me was, and I think it took me a long time to figure this out, but how to heal. I had no idea how to heal. Have you heard any feedback that made you rethink certain things? Because obviously, you know, when you're designing the game, even though you have testers, it's kind of in a bubble, and now it's out in the wild.
Yeah. So those two things, healing and leveling are things that players either don't do or don't know how to do or don't realize they can do, or every version of that. And so we're working on a patch now for all of that stuff. We're like, let's give Roger some extra bits of dialogue that tell you exactly how to do and what to do. Let's push the VFX on the milk bath for the healing pool a bit, you know, a bit more to make it more eye catching, stuff like that. The leveling of using the old cores to take into Danielle and leveling up. What leveling does is totally not communicated to the player at all. And the healing, those two things are like stuff we want to address, feedback we want to address.
I think I figured out what the cores do. I have not looked this up, but I'm not sure if it's out there. But it seems to make you stronger. I did notice that I was hitting bumpers down a lot easier.
Right. Exactly correct. So one of the ways we tried to telegraph that, and I don't think it's super successful now that I've watched all the feedback, but there are these canisters in a couple of rooms, and if your ball hits them, it turns like bright white. And then you'll notice that it slowly changes color as it turns back to a dull gray and then disappears. That bright whiteness is the top level of charge that a ball in the game can hold. And as you level up your core, you can change the ball from one level 1 through 10, 10 being that white, and then there's a different color for every level. And you're exactly right. It makes the ball stronger, makes you stronger, so that when you hit a bumper, it does more damage, quote-unquote damage, to the bumper. But that's not super obvious to players.
I have one last question. A game like this, right? Like a 10-hour game. How long did it take you from the very start till when the game gets released? And you still said you're going to like do a patch. So like, how long do you think it'll take from day one to like the very final patch to make a game like this?
Not knowing how much more we're going to add, we're talking about ideas that we still want to try. It took the principal development on Creature, it was 18 months. So for Bo and I, and we're very, very, very production oriented developers. Like we really try to build the game for our skill set on a reasonable budget, you know, the healthy work life balance and all that sort of stuff. That's like, I don't know, I guess probably 2 years would be my guess. And with the release being at that 18 month mark, it's a difficult question to answer, right? Because some of the games that I still play are like live games, you know, or like Celeste just came out with that last DLC. So it's like, wow, they're still crushing it.
It's something we always talk about on the podcast. Like, it's because like Patrick and I are like, our first love is movies, second would be video games. And when you review a movie, like usually you see like the final cut and, you know, you sit down for 2 hours, you go home, you write your review. And even like within time, your opinion of the movie might change, but you still saw like the full version. And with video games, even like consoles, it's really hard to review things. Like, I would not give the Nintendo Switch the exact same review score I gave it when it was first released, because it's improved. The same can be said for most games, and especially a game like Overwatch or Destiny or Fortnite that they constantly add to it, and there's patches, and it's just like, even Control, like one of the most beloved games of 2019, it still is getting patched. So it's a really hard medium to review, I think.
I think it all begins with a base. Like for me, and I've said this before multiple times on the podcast, it all begins with that, how it feels to play. And if something feels good to play, then it's so much easier. That foundation can easily be built upon. I think it's hard to patch in that good feeling afterwards. Yeah.
And you got to go from the core out,
Yeah. And one of the things about Creature in the Well that I liked, so yes, it was frustrating not knowing how to heal it first. And yet, that never turned me away from the game because I loved the way the game felt. And there was some satisfaction, honestly, in figuring out how to heal. It seems like the stupidest thing, but I got a lot of satisfaction figuring out how to heal. Like, yeah, all right, I did this. The game didn't tell me because it brought me back to, you know, I grew up in the 80s. So it brought me back a little bit to that time when games didn't always tell you everything. And with the cores, I kept upgrading them, wondering, what am I doing here? Until I started to notice, especially when I would go back into rooms, that I was mowing down things. And there were certain challenges that I couldn't beat before because they're timing-based, that all of a sudden now I could beat because I was much stronger. So the game, it requires you to pay attention, kind of like how the story, you need to go to all the little lore tablets and piece things together. And I liked that it kept me engaged that way, where I had to pay attention to my surroundings. It did teach. It just teaches in a different way than I think we're used to, and that can frustrate you know, modern gamers, because we have become accustomed to being told a lot of things. Well, I think we're going to wrap things up here, but is there anything else you wanted to say about Creature in the Well?
No, I mean, you guys have great questions. So I feel like we talked about all the cool little bits, and it's been helpful for me, actually. It's been insightful for me to just talk through it with people who, you know, who haven't been staring at it for the past 18 months.
Thank you, man. Well, I highly recommend anybody, especially, you know, I'm a big puzzle gamer, so this game has got me hooked. And I think anybody who is big into puzzles, especially, and just trying out a new kind of mechanic, it's sort of a, you know, reflex based puzzle game. I highly recommend people check it out, because this game has had me addicted to it. So
it's honestly fantastic. It's one of my favorite games of the year so far. I love it. I love it. And I happen to love pinball. There's actually a bar here in Montreal where we can go play like a bunch of video games, and especially pinball.
Nice.
So the combination of the dungeon crawler and everything about it, especially the art style. I love the art style. Like, I love the creatures, love the characters, love the world building. It's fantastic. I highly recommend it.
All right. Well, Adam Volker, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Adam, do you want to just plug maybe where our listeners can find you online if you want to be found? Like, maybe you're on Twitter.
Yeah, sure. I'm on Twitter at AVolkertron. So Adam Volker, AVolkertron. The game is at Creature Well, and creatureinthewell.com can give you, you know, like all the links to all the spots where you can pick up this title and stuff like that.
For sure. We'll include it in the show notes. And I guess that's it for now. We're going to take a break. And Patrick, when we come back, I believe we're going to talk about Daemon Ex Machina.
That is correct. We'll be back in a little bit. Welcome back. All right. So Nintendo has been just killing it, absolutely killing it with releases on the Switch. They're going to make it go broke if they can. At least they certainly seem to be trying. Who can keep up these days? I know I can't. But they've released another big game, Daemon Ex Machina, and Campbell Gill has played through the entire thing and reviewed it for GoombaStomp.com. You can go check out his written review there. But we want to hear straight from the horse's mouth. Campbell, how is Daemon Ex Machina?
I will say that Daemon Ex Machina is really good. In a nutshell, that's what I can say about it. I will say that, to give a little more detail on it, the demo came out earlier this year, right? I think it was February or something like that. I played it because I was super interested in it. And I was just burned by that. It just did not feel good at all. So much was just, the performance was terrible. It was difficult, all this kind of stuff. But then later, you know, this year, like a few weeks, I think it was actually last week, now that I think of it. Yeah. I got the code and I started playing the final game. The improvement is so, so, so good. I mean, it feels so much better to play now. It feels polished and refined. It just focuses on that cool mech action that you really want from these kinds of games, you know? And it's certainly not perfect in any sense, because the story, I don't want to get into that right now, but the story is simply dreadful. But the game itself, it's good. Awesome gameplay, really disappointing story. So that's like my reaction in a nutshell.
I did try it out when I went to the Nintendo offices last week and I got to try out the Switch Lite. So I played it on the Switch Lite, which is not necessarily the best way to play a game like this. But I can say that I was really impressed with the controls and how smooth it ran. Because the good thing about demos is, what I like about it is it gives us, the consumers, sort of like an idea as to what to expect. But if the game isn't finished, you could be playing a faulty product, and then it can work to the disadvantage of the publisher / developer, because then you might lose interest in the game. But they did ask for feedback from consumers and fans, and they listened to the feedback. And I don't know what the demo was like, but everyone says it was terrible. But from what I played about 30 minutes of this. I actually liked it a lot. But yeah, the story seemed kind of really poorly written.
Yes. To get into the story, I hate to go straight into the absolute worst aspect of the game so soon, but let's just rip that Band-Aid off. The story, it starts out pretty decent. Like, you know, it's a mech action game. You don't expect this amazing, poignant story out of it. So it starts out with a premise of, like, I think it's the moon. Like, a part of the moon blows up, falls to Earth, and then the radiation from the moon bits, they cause all the AI, all the robots on Earth to become corrupted and just want to destroy humanity, because that's how sci-fi works, I guess. So that's a decent setup for this kind of game. But then what they do is they add in a lot of other elements to it, way too many elements. Like, they add in mercenaries, like individual mercenary groups that were use these mechs to fight off the evil robots. That makes sense. Then they have different corporations that hire these mercenaries. And then they have the relationships between all these different mercenaries. And they introduce, but before each mission, they introduce like a dozen different characters at a time. And they're all incredibly one note. And it's just, the thing is, like, when you play this kind of game, you want to get into the action. I want to blow stuff up, you know? But instead, what you get is like 10 minutes of super repetitive, flat dialogue talking about, man, war is bad, isn't it? Yeah, basically, that's what it boils down to. So, and none of these characters have any dimensionality at all. Like, most of the characters, they're named. Most of them are named after emotions or nouns or something. Like, one character is named Grief. So that's basically all of his character right there. He's sad.
Whose parents named them Grief? By the way, that's terrible. What a terrible thing to do that kid.
I know. They named him Grief. And it's like, why would you do such a thing? And then you've got what other characters? You've got a guy named Savior. And he's basically your edgy anime hero, you know, your edgy anime anti-hero, I should say. But just, it's not good. And the thing is, they really rely on these characters to push the story forward, when instead, I think it would have been more appropriate if they had focused more on the actual evil robot threat and be like, all right, we've got this attack going. Let's handle this. Instead, what they do is they focus so much on these characters interacting with one another, they just forgot to make you actually care about these characters. So there's moments in the story that feel like super like they should be emotional. You've got this dramatic orchestral and piano music and stuff going. And just because you have no idea who these characters are, it just falls completely flat. So that's, there's my... on the story.
You had me at Moon Blows Up.
Yes.
That's cool. I don't know how the Earth would work after that, but
it's like a weird sci-fi sequel to Majora's Mask.
Moon Blows Up. That's a great premise. I mean, the tides and all these what happens? They could really get into that. So, all right. So the story isn't good. We got that part out of the way. All right. And you know what? I'm not a big fan of video game stories anyway, so I don't really care except for Fire Emblem Three Houses, which is amazing. Well, not the story, but the characters. But I think, so I did play the demo, and I don't remember it being awful, but it was not thrilling in any way. It just wasn't fast. It didn't seem like, it was a little clunky. The way you aimed was kind of weird. And so you're saying that now that is not the case, that now it feels more like a satisfying mech game.
Absolutely. Yeah, what happened was, I remember with you, like you pointed out, the demo wasn't good. There were so many issues with it, and it just felt, and you never felt like you were in control, which is a really big issue for such a fast-paced action game, you know? But now with the final product, it just feels so much more polished. Like, for instance, the aiming, they added gyro controls. You know, not only did they add gyro controls, but they also added new add-ons to your weapons and armor that allow you to lock on to enemies at further distances. And that means that you don't have to be swinging the camera around all the time manually just to figure out where you're shooting or where your enemies are. So it made that a lot more elegant. And just a lot of quality of life improvements just made it feel just so much more refined. It just made it really let you, it had such a good core to begin with, because, you know, you're piloting in this massive mech, you're fighting all these evil robots. It's so cool, but it was lost underneath all those little aiming issues and things like that. But now that they've cleared that up, it really focuses on that. That's really good.
You know what the big problem with this game is? It's like they've released this game about a week or two after they released Astral Chain, and I kind of feel like the same type of gamer that would want to play Daemon X Machina is the same type of person that would want to play Astral Chain. I could be wrong, but like the two sort of do have a lot of similarities, and I'm kind of confused as to why they decided to release these two games both in the month of September. Like, this game could have really have been released maybe in like August. I kind of feel like it's just the worst time to release this game.
Absolutely.
It might have been polish reasons. They were obviously taking their time to polish up the gameplay. And then it becomes a situation of, well, we have so many things. Every month has a major game. Do we want to wait till next year, or do we just want to release it now? And because this was kind of our target date. It's an odd business decision. You're right. And I bet there are a lot of people who picked up Astral Chain because it came out first and maybe won't get Daemon X Machina. But there may be, you know, folks like me who are disappointed by Astral Chain and maybe want to try out Daemon X Machina, because that could be, it could provide that sort of action thrill that we didn't get from the other game.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I'm glad to hear that the game is actually really good. I mean, your review was incredibly positive. I was sort of like worried, like when I got the review code, because I had played it, like I said, I played it last week, and I was going to review it, but then I just, like, you know, once again, I was just too busy, and so I gave you the code, and I was like, oh my god, this is the first big game he reviews for us. Is he going to hate it and dread it, and he's going to, like, you know what I mean? Like, it's not fun to play through a game you don't like, and then you have to review it. So, all in all, it's pretty positive. I mean, if anyone's interested in the game, like, I don't know what the price point is, but it seems like you highly recommend the game.
Yeah, my thought is, if you're already into the genre, if you're like, man, I want another big mech game, you know, it's been so long since we've gotten something like Armored Core, or even, let's say, the only recent one that comes to mind is something like Xenoblade Chronicles X. You know, if you want a big mech game, this is awesome for you. If you're not into that, it might be a little trickier to recommend, you know, just because it doesn't have many aspects aside from the mech action gameplay to recommend it. Like, if the story were super good, then I could give it a wider recommendation. But in this case, yeah.
What about the visuals? Do the visuals? So one of my questions about this game when I first played the demo was I going to get tired of the visuals? I like the clean look and everything, but is there enough variety? Did the visuals actually grab you?
I would say there's enough variety. I would wish that there was maybe a little more, because they do have some really striking environments in there. Like, they have these one area that's kind of like this purplish jungle with a ruined city in it. And it's really striking color contrast between, you have the mechs going through there, generally silver or black. You've got the purplish trees. You've got the red moon, because the moon is always red because it blew up, apparently. So, again, but that means it's a super striking visual style. So a lot of it just, it looks really cool in all those different environments. I will say they tend to reuse the same general ruined city area a lot. And different, a lot of areas tend to use the same general color scheme of orange and grays and blacks and things like that. But overall, just with the, there's a lot of really cool color contrast. You know, again, you've got blacks and oranges and whites and things like that. And it sounds, it looks really cool for that reason. Like I said in the review, like if you look at some screenshots, a lot of them look like they could have just come straight out of a super stylish manga. You know, it's a really cool looking game.
Well, that's good. I mean, so that might be, between that and the gameplay, it might be enough to get someone like me through it who doesn't really care about story anyway. You know, and I enjoyed something like Starlink, which isn't the greatest looking game of all time. It is very repetitive in many ways. I think it has very similar characteristics in that the environments might be different colors, but they reuse the same assets. And it's repetitive gameplay. Only I found the gameplay to be solid. I enjoyed it. And thus, I was able to play through the game twice, just simply because it was sort of like a comfort game, right? It felt good to play. It didn't have anything overly annoying in there to me, and I didn't care about the ridiculous story that was going on. So, whatever. I still enjoyed the game. So, Daemon X Machina maybe might sort of fit that bill.
You know, Patrick, I think it has, like, a huge audience, because, like, they have a special edition on Amazon. It costs $300. Like, you know what I mean? For them to make a special edition of this game that costs $300, they know they have an audience. I'm kind of, like, curious to see how well it does commercially, and also critically, because I haven't actually noticed any other reviews pop up yet. But anyhow, I mean, if it wasn't so bloody expensive, I would probably buy it, but... Choices, man, choices. For me personally, it's just like it's the wrong time for them to release this game for me.
All right, so that should about do it for Daemon X Machina. To me, it sounds kind of interesting, and I'm very curious, especially after reading your review. Listeners, go check out Campbell's review. It's on GoombaStomp.com. It's very positive, but he definitely goes into all the problems with it as well, so I think you get a pretty good picture, a pretty good idea of what to expect. All right, when we come back, we are going to talk about the latest weird thing from Nintendo. You all know, if maybe you've seen the trailer, maybe you haven't, but the Weird Ring. We'll be back in just a bit. All right, guys, we are back. Nintendo finally goes Nintendo again. You know, it'd been a long time since they'd done anything truly weird, unless you count 1-2 Switch, but that was sort of an outlier, right? Nope, they're back. They got a great new peripheral, and it is and a game to go along with it. It's not quite what any of us expected.
Excuse me, I will
not
say
true.
That, yeah. In the piece that we published about like last week when Nintendo first teased it, we asked, why can't this be an open-world motion-controlled yoga rhythm action game? And it turns out that we weren't that far from the truth. So
exactly. And everyone made fun of me on Workplace when I mentioned that. Everyone's like, no, it's just going to be a typical like Wii Fit. I'm like, no, it's going to be something completely different.
I think we, again, I'm going to stick with what I originally said. It isn't any quite what we predicted, but a combination of everything that everybody predicted. Tim and I thought it was going to be more fitness-based. It clearly is fitness-based. Rick, you said it was going to be like an adventure game. And
it is. I said it's going to be an adventure fitness game, though.
Yeah, but you thought it would be more based on more a game than a fitness thing. Now, and then we were all wrong, assuming there was some sort of online component because they were traveling all over the world. That was not mentioned so far in the new trailer. But, of course, everybody, we're talking about Ring Fit Adventure, which is a really weird name that I'm not sure is going to catch on. And it was given a really weird trailer. I'm not going to get into the actors that were in the trailer.
We have to talk about this because the thing is, Nintendo missed out on a golden opportunity to release a horror game, because when those actors came on screen, I could not help but think that this was going to turn into some kind of like first person shooter type of horror game. Like those, like, I don't know what is up. We always talk about this week after week on the podcast, at least I do, when it comes to Nintendo's marketing and how bizarre their marketing decisions are. I don't know who the casting agent was in hiring these two people, but like you said, Patrick, they were so distracting. They came across as so creepy. It was like watching like a demented version of Desperate Housewives. It was like Invasion of the Body Snatchers. It was like that old TV show, V. You know, remember V?
Yes, with the lizard
V
aliens.
V for Visitors. Yeah. It was so bizarre. And I think the thing is like I watched it like three times and I still have no idea what the product's about because I was so distracted by their performances.
Yeah, the guy's elocution was just mesmerizing. The way he pronounced every word so perfectly, it just didn't seem like a human person speaking. And the expression on the woman's face struck me as serial killer-esque. But I don't want to, maybe I've been watching Mindhunter too much, but that would been like a red flag if I was, you know, in the FBI. But you're right, they were so distracting. I don't want to bash them, but they seemed like aliens trying to be humans. But they're actors, they were doing their best, and they were probably directed a certain way as well, right? You got to blame a lot of this on the director. The director gave them these notes.
I totally agree. I'm blaming it on the marketing, which therefore goes with the director. But if that is their best performance, someone needs to cast them right away into a horror film. That's all I'm saying.
Agreed. Total agreement. However, we probably should talk about the actual product they laid out. I'm just going to go like general. What did you guys actually just think of Ring Fit Adventure, the whole concept of it?
I mean, I'll say I was pleasantly surprised in a way. Like, I was expecting it to be like the Nintendo's next attempt at being a Wii Sports, you know, but it turned out to be something more than that, which is pretty cool looking. But yeah, it's interesting.
Interesting is a great word. You know what? I think this is a prime opportunity for me to do something, for me to do a challenge. I should pick this up day one, and I should actually monitor how fit I am day one to like 30 days later. Like, am I going to lose weight? Are my abs going to look better? Like, am I going to get a 6-pack, an 8-pack? Like, in all honesty, I would be willing to do that experiment. I will use this thing every single day to actually see if you can get a good workout.
Yeah. Can you get enough of a 6-pack to actually block real life enemy attacks? That would be
asking
amazing.
The real questions here.
We always like on the podcast, Campbell, we always talk about Nintendo's weird decisions, not just in terms of like their marketing, but the stuff they make, right? Like the games, stuff like from the stuff from like Wii Sports to 1-2 Switch and everything in between. But that's kind of like why we love Nintendo, because sometimes it's so bizarre and it doesn't really necessarily interest us as consumers, but it's nice to see them experiment. But you never know, like, there's the bottom line is I think all three of us are curious, and the fact that we, and I guess most people, are curious to at least try out this thing is like a good thing. Like, it's a good sign for Nintendo. I don't know if I want to like spend $80, but again, I would be willing to do it if it's going to like get me to do something sort of like more creative, where I do release a set of like articles, let's say weekly for like a period of 3 months to see if I actually, if the exercise actually works, like, am I going to be in better shape? Like, but that's sort of like because I run a website. You mean, like, if I didn't work for Goomba Stomp or didn't do this podcast, I don't think I would care. I don't even think I would notice this sitting in the store shelf.
So the curious thing for me is Wii Fit made a lot of sense because Wii Sports attracted all age ranges.
of players. Like, so you had, you know, everybody from, you know, soccer moms to little kids and everybody in between, even in grandpa and grandmas, right? Everybody wanted a Wii to sort of play Wii bowling. And so Wii Fit, you could sell to a crowd that didn't necessarily play video games, but was intrigued by the idea of working out. The Switch's audience, I'm not sure skews, do I want to say, old enough for to capture that workout audience. I'm not sure that it does. I think that, many Switch players probably already have a way to work out. I don't think that, and it's bad that they made this or anything, but I'm curious as to what they think the audience for this would be. And it's clearly why maybe they made more of a game out of it, like a campaign mode. And then they still have the mini games and stuff, but that campaign maybe is trying to appeal to the gamers.
But you know what? We can poke fun at this all day long, but I remember when the 1-2 Switch came out, and I wrote this really like nasty piece about why I thought it was like one of the stupidest ideas Nintendo ever did. And that, like, 1-2 Switch sold a million copies. Now, to be fair, it sold a million copies at launch because, like, there just was only six games to buy, and most people just wanted to go home with at least two games in their hand. But it did sell really well. But Nintendo Labo did not do very well. And I know it's a completely different product, but I'm just saying, like, we're 3 years into the life cycle of the Nintendo Switch. I think you're right. I don't think most Switch players are the target audience because, like, Switch is pretty popular. They sold, like, roughly 40 million units worldwide, but it's not to the extent of, like, the Wii where your grandma is playing with, like, Wii Sports. But I think the biggest problem, and again, it goes back to the marketing, because marketing is very important, guys. The biggest problem is the name. I don't remember what it's called now. I keep forgetting. Really? Like, Wii Sports is catchy.
Three times before we started this segment, I had to look it up. Ring Fit Adventure. I don't like the name at all. It sounds so bland. It sounds like, remember all those knockoffs of Wii Sports that would come out? And it would be like Island Activities or something like that. It would just be such a generic name. And Ring Fit Adventure sounds to me like one of those. It doesn't sound like a Nintendo product at all. Has no catchiness. That they're usually pretty good. Like, Wii Fit was a great name. It was very clean and simple. And the balance board, like all the colors and everything surrounded it, it was all like everything was just designed perfectly, right? To appeal to the consumer that they were going for, which wasn't necessarily gamers, but just sort of everybody. Ring Fit Adventure, that name is going to appeal to gamers.
Not at all. And you know, even 1-2 Switch, the name 1-2 Switch is very catchy. It aligns with the actual Switch, the actual console, the hardware. But also, like, I don't know if you remember the commercials and even, like, the posters and the advertisements. It was all very colorful, and it just popped, you know? Like, you would take notice if you were walking by and you saw an ad for 1-2 Switch at, like, the bus stop. This is so bizarre. Like, everything from, like, the marketing to the actors to the commercial to the naming, the branding, it's, I don't know, I don't think this is going to be a success at all.
Switch Fit. I don't know why they didn't, like, it's so close to Fitbit. Like, and they have similar ideas with tracking your statistics and stuff like that in-game. Like, Switch Fit would have been just fine, and I think it would have been much better. They could have included the game but relied less on it, you know? Show people how it's going to work. Oh, you get to play this game, but you also get to play all these mini-games. And I think, I have a feeling that most of the people who buy this thing are going to be sticking to the mini-games and not the actual quest, because I don't know that I want to just run in place. There's something, jogging is fine, right? Because your body is made to go that way, to run in that motion. And I'm sure there's fitness experts that can tell you that running in place isn't bad for you. But I don't think it feels very good to just sit there and move your legs up and down in place for a long period of time as you run as this character. It's different than jogging. So I don't know. I see people probably gravitating more towards the mini games, and I almost feel like they should have relied on that aspect a little bit more.
Yeah, I don't know. I guess someone's got to try out the product, right? Like, I'm very interested to know if you actually get in shape playing this. I forget the name of it. Whatever it's, I'm going to call it Switch Fit just to make my life simpler. Switch Fit, right? You actually get in shape. But I would be willing to actually sacrifice $80, pick it up, and try it out just so I can write a bunch of articles about it. But again, that's me being like a blogger / podcaster. Is my nephew or my friends or my cousins going to want to buy this? I don't know anybody that wants to buy this.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know who it's for, but I'm always, you said this already, I love Nintendo and I love that they did it. I love that they shoot for the moon and everything. They try out any little weird old idea that they can throw out there. And this is another one. And I'm always curious about anything that Nintendo does. I'm not saying I'm going to buy this, but it always catches my attention, especially with that crazy weird ad. So, and as far as the game goes, it looks very
very cookie cutter RPG type thing. Looks like you're traveling in a straight line, going from place to place, fighting enemy to enemy. It looks very bland, the actual game. But I am curious about the workout part. Like you are, Rick. Like, how well would this actually work? Because we fit. It didn't deliver like the greatest workout of all time, but it did something. It allowed you to do something, and it certainly, you know, worked on certain areas.
I wonder if, because so the actual, the entire package comes with a strap that you put on your leg, yes. And then there's the actual rubber wheel, right? Yeah. And I'm wondering if they can actually release like games like in the future that would still work with the rubber wheel and the strap that goes in your leg. Like, for example, if they would come out with some kind of like peach or daisy yoga session, right? Like a game that's just yoga, but you use the exact same tools.
Oh God, watch all the creepy people who want that. There'll be too many downward dog references. I think, well, there's electronics within the wheel. So it can clearly do some things because it's sensing pressure, right? They said it reacts to pressure. The strap is just similar to the strap, I think, that came with Wii Fit. Or at least, I remember you could strap Wii remotes to yourself as well. But this wheel has me intrigued because there must be some other things. This whole reacting to pressure thing, I like the idea of that. And you can, like, you can actually make it easier on yourself. And so I wonder how much resistance it actually gives you. I'm very curious to get my hands on that wheel. And I'd like to see what other things it can do other than you just pushing it in to do a pec exercise or something like that. I'm curious to see what else it can do.
Yeah, I'm just super intrigued in it from it.
Does anybody know when it comes out?
Oh, it's October 10th, I think it was. October 18th.
Man, again, golden opportunity. Release something in October, a horror game, something like in the vein of like Resident Evil 7, where you use this rubber wheel to go around like killing people or run away from a mad serial killer.
Yes, run away from a serial killer. That'll get your heart rate up.
Not just a serial killer, from the presenters in the video. Run away from them. It's perfect.
If you ran into them in a haunted house, you would be frightened. There's no question about that. It would, yeah, they had a good opportunity for that. I guess they were, but again, they're trying to appeal to a weird audience. I'm not entirely sure which one it is, but we'll see how interested people get as it gets closer to release. And I'm going to be very curious about the reviews to this one to see how in depth this main game is and how many mini games there are and how much fun you can have with those, maybe as part of a group. But we'll see. It's certainly an interesting concept. It's very Nintendo. All right, guys, I think that should do it for today's show. So let's do our little goodbyes here. Campbell, where can we find you online?
All right. Well, obviously, you can see the stuff I write on GoombaStomp.com. If you want to connect with me on social media, you can find me at Campbell S. Gill on Twitter. Twitter, that was a very interesting way to pronounce that. Twitter.
Pronounce it like the guy from the ad. Your elocution was.
Yeah. We're talking Twitter. About it, so now I'm pronouncing things like him. He's infiltrating my mind.
What do you humans call Twitter?
Twitter.
And of course, you can find me online right at Goomba Stomp, a lot in the movie section, but occasionally games as well. We're pretty much wrapping up our coverage at the Toronto International Film Festival, but there are a ton of reviews, some pretty big ones, including Joker and Knives Out. You guys should want to check those out. Check out our reviews. And you can, of course, find me at Sorted Cinema. Ricky D, where can we find you?
You can find me at GoombaStomp.com. I write about TV shows, movies, anime, video games, and so much more. I handle the official Twitter account for GoombaStomp, and you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Tumblr, Pinterest, Instagram, you name it. We are all over the internet.
Yeah, and be sure to give us a review on iTunes, guys. Really helps us out, helps the podcast grow, which helps us get great guests like the one that we had today. You know, we love interviewing indie developers, any developers, really. It's a lot of fun for us, and we think we can get some pretty interesting things out of it. So,
leave us a review. The show is free to listen to. We don't make money out of it. It's very important for you to not just leave reviews for us, but any podcast you listen to, especially if they don't monetize their podcast, like if they're not asking you for money or whatever, leave the podcast a review. Good or bad, leave reviews. It is so important for podcasts.
Yeah, it helps a lot. All right, that should do it. We'll be back next week with more Nintendo goodness. Talk to you guys later.